Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of January. Our guest this hour says that Pakistan is perhaps the most important country in the war on terrorism. And according to a recent survey, an in-depth survey of Pakistani public opinion, there is majority support for a moderate and democratic Islamic state. But a small and significant minority is showing sympathy for Islamic militant groups. Most want Islam to play a larger role in Pakistani society. The majority favors more democratic political system and rejects Talibanization. Our guest has had a keen eye on Pakistan for quite some time. Professor Christine Fair is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and her recent work includes security competition between India and Pakistan, the internal security of Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, the causes of and support for terrorism in South Asia, U.S. strategic relations with India and Pakistan. She has also worked with the United States Institute for Peace and as a political affairs officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. We'll, of course, be looking at the postponed elections, the implications for Pakistan of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto's death, assassinated in late December. So there's a lot to catch up on. We've done many shows on this, but not for some time, as we have focused our attention on primaries and caucuses. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee callers 227-2050. And should you care to send us an email, you can do that. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Christine Fair, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me why you call Pakistan the most important country in the war on terrorism.
Well, and there are a number of reasons. One, 9/11, of course, started in Afghanistan. That's where al-Qaeda was based. They were holed up with their Taliban allies. The international efforts to secure Afghanistan and to rout the Taliban and to ensure that Afghanistan cannot and will not be in the future a base for such acts of international terrorism in large measure hinge upon Pakistan for a number of reasons. First and foremost, the United States still requires Pakistan as a logistics base. All of the fuel for the war effort in Afghanistan get offloaded at Karachi, move safely and securely for the most part through Pakistan and onto Afghanistan. Second, and this has become very apparent in recent years, is that the tribal areas of Pakistan that abut Afghanistan have been and a very important sanctuary for the Taliban and al-Qaeda, who are launching attacks in Afghanistan. But equally important, this territory has served as the area from which militants all over the world have tried to stage attacks. And in fact, all the major conspiracies that have been disrupted in the UK and Europe have had various footprints through Pakistan and through the tribal areas in particular. And so I think these are some reasons that certainly focus our attention upon Pakistan. But I also might add that Pakistan is one of the most populous Muslim countries in the world. As such, it has a lot of influence not only in the South Asian region, but also in the Middle East. And it's important that we have a relationship with a country that is so pivotal geographically, socially, culturally, and politically in the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm. What kind of relationship, after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, what kind of relationship do we have with this country right now? What kind of relationship do we have with Musharraf?
Well, actually, you know, I was a part of that survey that you cited. So I know those data intimately well and what those data say. What we can say very clearly is that President Bush has a deeply personalized relationship with Musharraf. And this has really put tension between the Pakistani citizenry and the United States. Over the years, I've been going to Pakistan for so long, and I have a long relationship with that country and a deep fondness. And I've always been dismayed by comments to the effect of, this was very poignant when I was there in 2006 when President Bush was making his trip to the region. Many Pakistanis, be it rickshaw drivers versus very sophisticated editors of important English dailies, would all say very similar things. When President Bush talks about India, he talks about its culture, its people, its civilization, its democracy. When he turns to talk about Pakistan, he only talks about Musharraf. In Pakistan, President Bush and President Musharraf are conflated in the term Busharraf. And so the problem is it's very striking. And as a consequence of this, President Musharraf doesn't have a lot of legitimacy, increasingly less in given the actions that he's undertaken in the last 6 months. And this has made his ability to lead his nation in the war on terror, as their war on terror, very difficult.
Yeah, I think it was you I read, and tell me if this quote rings a bell with you. Maybe it would be better for the country, for Pakistan, if Musharraf moved on.
Well, I'm actually not a fan. I mean, that may be empirically the case. I mean, Musharraf, but move on can mean different things. You can take the Turkey approach, you know, where he basically decides, I've had a good run, I've had an interesting legacy, and I'm going to become more of a figurehead president. I think it'd be very difficult to expect or to imagine President Musharraf to have his own epiphany and decide maybe it would be best for me to retire to some beach somewhere. I don't think that's very likely. I know the International Crisis Group has certainly advocated that. My position is really one of the United States has too long supported an individual. And we have to get out of the business, I would say, period, of supporting individuals. We need to be supporting processes. We need to be supporting institutions. Similarly, the United States was very keen in supporting former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, not because they wanted democracy per se, but they thought that by having some semblance of free and fair elections, Musharraf could sort of drape himself in her cloak of electoral legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And in that process, Benazir Bhutto also became deeply tainted. And in the survey that you opened with, we did question Pakistanis about their views of Benazir Bhutto and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif as well as Musharraf. And both Bhutto and Musharraf came in abysmally in that poll.
Why did she come in abysmally?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, since she's been assassinated and she died a very gruesome death, it's become fashionable to sort of depict her as a beacon of democracy back from self-imposed exile to lead her country. Of course, that's all nonsense. She was a kleptocrat, not living in exile, but living on the lam, absconding from justice. And Pakistanis do not have such a short memory that they don't recall her two previous tenures of prime minister, where she essentially benefited herself and her family and her patrons and did very little for the country. Similarly, Nawaz Sharif built some neat roads, but he also primarily personally benefited and then distributed gains to his patronage network. So Pakistanis were not so naive about Benazir. Now, she was an important symbol. I mean, Menaz Isfahani wrote an excellent editorial talking about this. She was a problematic figure for, you know, she didn't do anything for women, quite frankly. But the fact that she was there as a female, she offered a symbol to Pakistani women that's really no longer there. And she wrote very elegantly about a photo of Benazir Bhutto pregnant and standing on a tank and accepting a salute. It's almost impossible to imagine a woman in Pakistan assuming that position ever again, at least in my lifetime.
I think the other thing that makes people take to her story is, why in the world did she put herself at such huge risk? She must have known that this could have happened to her. She knew that. She wrote about it. Why would she have done that?
Well, this, I think, kind of goes to her psychology and her view of herself and her relationship with her people. Many people have noted that she almost had a messianic-like self-perception, that she had to be among her people, that she had to touch her people. And so I think her perceptions of herself and what she needed to do compelled her to make really unsound decisions that not only put her own life at risk, as you know, that's obvious, but it also put at risk those nearest to her, her supporters, as well as innocent folks that just came out to sort of see the madam, you know, the Mahultrama, as they call her in Urdu, return. So it's very unfortunate. You know, you would have hoped that someone who was that prominent would have been a little bit more secure. As I like to say, what is the point of having an armored vehicle if you're going to stick out of a moonroof? I mean, this is, by the way, I've never been in an armored vehicle that had a moonroof. I think that was her custom vehicle, not a state-provided vehicle.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about these elections. They've been postponed until February 18. Will they happen, and who the heck's going to be on a ballot?
Well, I mean, I think we spoke about this back in December. I was, along with everyone else, very skeptical that the January elections were going to be free and fair, or at least maximally free and fair. A number of structural issues were in place then. The media is still muzzled. They cannot say adverse things about the government or its leadership or its key institutions. The media is very important, by the way. One outlet in particular will probably not be allowed to resume broadcasting until after the elections, and that's GEO. And the reason being, they have very good grassroots coverage, and they can offer a some approximation to exit polling. You don't want that if you're going to rig the election. The Election Commission is deeply problematic. It's led by partisan folks. It, in turn, it has its composition affected by the stacked judiciary. When Musharraf proclaimed an extra-constitutional emergency, he made the judiciary sign an oath, swear an oath to it. Now, if you're a judge worth your salt, you're going to stick to the Constitution, which is vitiated by that the order that Musharraf issued. So those judges that stuck to the Constitution refused to swear an oath to this provisional constitutional order were sacked. He has not restored the judiciary, and both the High Court and the Supreme Court staff the Election Commission, and as disputes wind their way through from the Election Commission up to the High Court and the Supreme Court, you can obviously see that if you've got a bunch of kangaroo courts, allegations of electoral misconduct are not going to be freely and fairly disputed. There were issues with the voters list. Millions of people were missing, then millions of people were added. They won't let review. Huge restrictions placed upon the parties. In the important federally administered tribal areas, political parties are not allowed to act, which means only the Islamist parties who have access to mosques and madrasas are allowed to mobilize their constituents. And the list goes on and on. And I might add that not only do all of those issues remain in place, the United States has really missed an opportunity to say to Mr. Musharraf, President Musharraf, that these issues must be resolved. It's missed an opportunity to forge consensus with the international community to equally put pressure on Musharraf to lift these obvious impediments to free and fair elections. And just by final weight of noting, should the election prove to be rigged, i.e., should a pro-Musharraf candidate emerge, despite what we know will happen on the ground, which is a large sympathy vote for Benazir Bhutto's party, as well as support for Nawaz Sharif, chaos is going to break loose. So the scope and consequence for vote irregularities and rigging will be, I don't even want to contemplate what the consequences could be.
And has the U.S. administration put any pressure on Musharraf, or are they staying out of this, Christine?
Well, I mean, there have been some promising signs. The U.S. ambassador has made a number of very helpful and forceful statements about institutions, which is a welcome move from previous folks occupying that post who basically put accolades on Musharraf. Condoleezza Rice made a few promising comments, but the general approach has been that this is one of Pakistan's internal affairs, and we don't want to interfere with that. Now, of course, that's preposterous. The United States is completely willing to interfere in Pakistan's internal affairs when it chooses to. But I think the bottom line is that the United States has no plan B. Its plan A is Musharraf, Musharraf, Musharraf. Mm-hmm. And plan B is basically comprised of how to make plan A work rather than realizing plan A is dead in the water.
You've talked about the assassination of Benazir Bhutto only strengthening Islamic militants. Do you see signs that has happened?
Well, the way this stuff works with militant groups, by the way, it's true of all military groups, recruitment gets a pump up when things appear to be going their way. All of the images that we've seen splattered on CNN and elsewhere all find their way into recruitment materials, recruitment DVDs. They may not be saying so in English or in languages that get picked up and translated and disseminated, but all of this stuff basically gives a plus up to their effort to recruit new militants. It gives them a sense, look how successful we've been. We've tried to kill Musharraf. We've tried to kill the Minister of Interior. We've tried to kill so many people, but here we've succeeded. Mm-hmm. The other thing that it does, it actually increases contributions to their efforts. Again, everyone wants to support a winner in this world. And in different cells are competing for patronage, for money and for recruits. And so when a cell can pull off a spectacular attack like this, it benefits not only their recruitment numbers, which allows them, I might add, to then select better people, right? When you've got more people who want to be a terrorist than is a need for terrorists, like any hirer, they can pick the best one. So it helps them improve the quality of their recruitment, therefore the quality of the terror they can perpetrate in the future, and it also helps them get money. By the way, with the current situation that Musharraf is in, you know, his security forces are really put in a tough spot. They're having to police their own people, not go after the militants. And as we saw this morning, there were a large number of police officers that were called to keep in check an expected demonstration in support of restoration of the judiciary. And those poor police officers who were underpaid, out there trying to do their job and serve their country and their people, were massacred by a suicide bomber today. Gee. About 20-some, those police officers are so exposed, they are so poorly trained, they are so poorly equipped, and they are so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. So you are, by your statements earlier, indicating that you believe it was these terrorist groups who were responsible for her assassination. There, of course, has been some discussion about whether or not the government was responsible.
Well, I mean, that is my belief. I next to Benazir Bhutto and her associates who lost their, well, she lost her life and her associates were injured. Musharraf is not going to recover from this. He really needed a patina of free and fair elections to continue on with some degree of legitimacy, both in the eyes of his people, but certainly in the eyes of the international community. I think Musharraf, apart from losing his life, was a huge loser in this. And that's what made it, I think, from a militant's point of view, a double score. They imperiled this guy that they deride as Musharraf, who's fighting a war on Islam. And, of course, they also took out a woman who has never enjoyed support among the Islamist element. I mean, some of the Islamist parties would make convenient deals with her for political expediency. But when I was a student in Pakistan back in the mid-90s, it was not uncommon to have mullahs from various mosques say that a vote for Benazir is, you know, tantamount to sin and, you know, things of that nature. So for the militants, it was really a double victory. They got rid of her, and they crippled. They certainly crippled Musharraf.
Oof. Well, the obvious question is, what's the way to a better, more peaceful Pakistan? And we will ask that question in a moment. Christine Fair is our guest this hour, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. And we are looking at the implications for Pakistan of Benazir Bhutto's death. We are also looking at what's been happening with Musharraf, what the relationship between the United States and Pakistan is right now, what it is that the people in Pakistan want, and how to make sure that it's a more secure, peaceful country. We'll move into that conversation in a moment. We welcome your phone calls, as always. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Lines are open for you right now. We also have this, what do you call it, this email thing. Right, you can use that as well. And that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Thursday, what a lovely book. This was recommended by the New York Times book editor when we were doing our Best of 2007, and it has been considered a Best of 2007 book. Mildred Armstrong Kalish will join us. Her book is Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we start our calls with Dan. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask your guest if she's familiar with the work of Greg Mortensen and his book, Three Cups of Tea.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got the
I've never read it. I mean,
okay, Greg, just briefly, Greg Mortensen was a mountain climber,
yeah,
and he stumbled near death, having been lost and slept exposed into a remote Pakistani village. And he was shown to the house of the village leader and basically treated like royalty. They saved his life. And as a result of that, he vowed to build them a school, and that turned into his career. He spent his entire life raising funds and building schools in remote rural Pakistan. He's known as Dr. Greg. But his book, Three Cups of Tea, talks about his efforts simply to bring education to the children in the remote rural villages, and how this has been probably the single most successful thing to end some of the strife and conflict that we normally associate with underdeveloped countries. I would highly recommend the book. Greg can travel in a lot of areas with total impunity and protection by Muslim friends, even though he's an American, because he's highly revered for the... Mm.
I think he's going to be in Wisconsin, too. I think we have him scheduled sometime in February for a show, so... That should be interesting. Thank you so much for the call. You know, and it's wonderful he's doing this kind of work. I'm after you painted a really dismal picture of what's going on in Pakistan right now, I'm fearful of democracy blooming there and thinking that we need millions of people like Dr. Greg in order to move the country along to a more peaceful place. What is that road, Professor Fair? What's the road to peace, to democracy?
Well, I'm actually a big fan of democracy. There's a lot of fears that Pakistan is the next Iran, and I actually think that's rubbish. There's actually no basis to compare Pakistan to Iran for a number of reasons that I won't bore you with. In fact, Pakistanis do not vote in large numbers for Islamist parties. Historically, they've been lucky if they can break double digits, and they did so in 2002, and that only with massive electoral manipulations that actually favored the Islamists. So under the most favorable of electoral circumstances, they could only pull 12%. And I might add that was not one party, but that was a collective of five Islamist parties. So on their own, none of them do terribly well at all.
Hmm.
So there is, so if you sort of think about how in the world would there ever be an Islamist takeover in Pakistan, well, it's certainly not going to happen through the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
Some people like to conjure up the idea of Islamists within the army taking over the country. That's also unlikely, at least in the near term. Although I might add that the Pakistan Army, like all armies, increasingly is reflecting the distribution of the population writ large. And Pakistan has become more pious over the years. But I might add, so have a lot of other countries. The Pew Foundation collects attitudes on religion and public life, and this is a global trend. I mean, we've certainly observed this in the United States. So being pious does not make you a militant, and I think far too often there's a tendency to conflate piety, political Islam, with militant Islam, and certainly in Pakistan that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Scott from La Crosse next. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning to you both. Another excellent program, Kathleen. Thank you so much. My question is this. From what we hear, and I'm sure you know there's a lot we don't hear, but from what we hear, by far the most powerful institution in Pakistan is the army. And being head of the army is probably the most powerful position. So why would somebody like Musharraf, when put in position to have to give up one or the other, why wouldn't he have just kept being the head of the army and giving up the presidency, which seems to be a lot more slippery slope to be on, particularly these days?
Well, actually, I'll be honest with you. I was very dubious that he was ever going to give up his uniform for precisely the reason that you noted. Without the uniform, he is just a short man who's called president. So, I mean, I was one of those people that wasn't going to bet anything valuable that he was actually going to give up the uniform. But there are actually some practical reasons why he should, and probably why ultimately he did. The army is, as you said, the most important institution, and the army sees itself as such. So the army will always put its corporate interests over that of any particular individual, even a person who thinks he's very important, like President Musharraf. So one of the things that was happening within the army, and this is just a mathematical exercise, Musharraf came in as chief of army staff in 1999. So that meant that there was approximately 8 to 9 years between him and his corps commanders. That is, in Army speak, about 2 generations. So the cultural divide that was emerging between him and his officers was ever expanding. And so this naturally raises questions, if you're Musharraf, about where your loyalties lie. Do people support you? To what extent do they really share your vision? And this is particularly important within Pakistan, because the bulk of the officers serving today took their commissions after Zia-ul-Haq came in and began active Islamization efforts of the army, and after the United States cut off military training in 1990. So many people in Pakistan will tell you that this is a much more conservative army, and it's a much more anti-American army than the personal attitudes of President Musharraf himself. And when you're in a precarious situation like Musharraf, when you're essentially a military dictator, your sole survival depends upon the protection of the military. And so I suspect that what was probably going on was that he was getting feedback from serving and retired individuals within the Army that was sort of educating him about, you've had a nice run, sir, as Chief of Army Staff, but it's probably good for you and good for the Army if you sort of remove your uniform and appoint a successor. And so I think that despite the tendency to want to stay on, I think the reality of the corporate pressures of the institution probably prevailed upon him.
May I ask one quick follow-up then?
Yes, of course. Go ahead, Scott.
In light of that, I heard a report the other day, I think on something on public radio, that the United States wouldn't be all that unhappy to find somebody else from the military to push Musharraf aside if, you know, elections are all bogus anyway, and essentially have another coup and put another uniform in that office. Now, that doesn't seem like a really good plan for U.S. interests if, in fact, it is a lot more conservative and Islamist military, right?
Well, there are other reasons why that is a really bad idea. At some point, the U.S. has to wake up and it has to realize that its best interests are not in supporting an individual and an institution that takes Pakistan beyond the path of what its own constitution calls for. Military dictatorship is extra-constitutional. Military officers actually take an oath that they will not interfere in politics. And to be president, you cannot occupy any other compensated post within the Pakistani government. So that, by the way, was why President Musharraf was always skating on thin ice. He had to constantly amend the Constitution to allow him to do something that was essentially unconstitutional. So the United States really has to wake up, and it has to realize that what's in its interest is actually what's in the interest of Pakistanis and the interests of the other countries in the neighborhood, and that is a stable, democratic Pakistan at peace with itself and at peace with its neighbors. This cannot happen by constantly supporting a military that engages what I call democracy interruptus. We have a tendency to look at the political parties, say that they're corrupt, say that they're anemic, that they are ineffective, and therefore the army is the only institution capable of running the country. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you look at USAID, we have tended to only fund military dictators who, during their tenure, eviscerate all of the important civilian institutions. So in some sense, the United States has subsidized the rapacious evisceration of Pakistan's democracy. Hmm. I'd like to see a reverse course immediately.
Hmm. Thank you, Scott, very much for the call. Would you say that the president had little choice when he formed this alliance with Musharraf simply because it was expedient and we needed to get forces in there to fight terrorism and to try and find bin Laden and to take on the Taliban, that we had no choice, but that was okay, but now it calls for a reassessment? Because we're fighting another war. We're not fighting the war against terrorism in Afghanistan very much anymore. But
oh, we should be, though.
Mm-hmm.
we're just sending another 3,500 Marines to Afghanistan against the request for some 7,000 Marines. So we're still there. And we, in fact, as a proportion of the troops there, Afghanistan's taken more American lives than Iraq has this year.
Really?
Yeah. As a portion of those that are there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Scott, so much for your call. Habu is next from Madison. Hi, Habu.
Yes, hello, good morning. I like as I listen to this conversation, and it seems like this person is quite well informed, and as by contrast, I'm hardly informed, and I'm hardly an expert in this area. But may I offer this perspective, which I have read in Pakistani and alternative newspapers? Really, Musharraf was all well and good for Pakistan until 9/11 unfolded. And that is when Richard Armitage went to Pakistan and said, we will enlist you on the war on terror, otherwise you will be bombed into the Stone Age, okay? So this put pressure on Musharraf to start clamping down on the federally administered tribes in northwest Pakistan, who are very independent and who resent interference. Now, they were giving harbor to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda types, and it is in their tradition to treat people coming through with a certain amount of hospitality. But what the United States wanted was that Musharraf carry out a very robust military action against this people, and which he did, but that met with a lot of resistance within the country and within the soldiers who were, A, fragging their commanders, B, were surrendering en masse, and C, were mutinying. So he was in a very untenable position, Musharraf, that is, and he signed a peace agreement with the tribal elders in those areas. Now, when this happened, Washington said, this is not our man, and we're going to wanted a regime change. Okay, he didn't have a color, but it was a regime change. And then came Bhutto, on a white horse, if you will, who was going to be more robust, more muscular, and it is not surprising that she was taken away. She was the people in Pakistan, especially the Pakistan Taliban, were not going to let her ever get a foothold there.
Professor Fair.
Well, actually, I agree in large measure with the caller. Your name is Abu, you said? I'm sorry.
Yes.
A couple of points of divergence. Before 9/11, Musharraf was actually a pariah. Pakistan was a pariah state. It was under at least five layers of sanctions. By virtue of cooperating with the United States, and it is clear that Musharraf had no choice. President Musharraf uses the expression bomb into the Stone Age in his biography. Armitage avers that he did not use that language, but no one disputes that Pakistan was pretty much told, you are either with us or you are against us. And that is, of course, the language that the Bush administration has used throughout this conflict. So there is no doubt that that's the case. But one of the benefits that immediately accrued to Musharraf was that he got out of those sanctions. Not only that, the sluice gates began to open for Musharraf and his institution, the army. Since 9/11, the army has received about, you know, $9 billion plus or minus, and Pakistan generally receives a paltry billion.
$9 billion.
Yeah, and that is, by the way, in overt funds. We don't know covert funds, but folks do circulate a number to the order of $10 billion. Mm. And Musharraf himself talks about very large rewards for specific high-value individuals that the military and its personnel received. So I would. Up to 9/11, Musharraf was very much a pariah. Afterwards, he became the golden-eyed boy of the blue-eyed boy of Washington. I actually do put a lot of culpability on the U.S. for expecting Pakistan to go in and conduct the kinds of operations that Pakistan was asked to do, for precisely the reasons that the caller described. I think there was an assumption that because Pakistan had been running the Taliban for so many years, and it was, and running other militant groups before it put its efforts fully behind the Taliban, that Pakistan would be able to run operations against them. And what has in fact happened is that, with one exception, the Pakistan military, which draws from elements of the 11th Corps in its Pakistan, in the regular army, but problematically large elements from a paramilitary outfit called the Frontier Corps, which draws from local personnel, they speak the language, they know the area, they have been decisively trounced. As a consequence, Pakistan has signed not one deal with the militants, but actually five. And in at least four of those cases, those deals essentially ratified military defeat on the ground. Mm. The ineptitude of the army, coupled with misreading of the population and a failure to adopt light lethal counterinsurgency maneuvers as opposed to large large movements of troops that are probably coming out of Pakistan's doctrinal usage against its conventional foe, India, resulted in a lot of civilian casualties, deeply pervasive alienation of the population in the area, and likely galvanized a wider Pashtun cum Islamist insurgency, which was further stoked by episodic but sanguinary unilateral U.S. action. So the disaster that is unfolding in Pakistan's tribal areas, I think, are the result of both Islamabad and Washington's misreading of the area and inept policy formulation that focused upon military solutions. The Pakistanis, to their credit, early on wanted a large development package for Fatah. The United States has only agreed to do so this year, to put $750 million into the tribal areas. That's the federally administered tribal areas, or Fatah, as it's often called. It's too little. It's too late. It's going to be very difficult to spend that money because of the security environment. So now, the other area where I disagree with the caller is that Washington was actually not that keen on Benazir Bhutto. She talked all her anti-terrorism, her counterterrorism discussions that she made very publicly were really to placate Washington, so that she could reassure Washington that was skeptical of civilian leadership being able to take a hard stance against the militant threat in Pakistan, that in fact she had the mettle to do so. But I can tell you, sitting here in Washington, there is yet no movement from supporting Musharraf. And as I said, I really support a policy of supporting institutions, not people. Institutions and processes.
Christine Fair is our guest this hour, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and she has spent a great deal of time in Pakistan. Her work includes security competition between India and Pakistan, the internal security of Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, the causes of and support for terrorism in South Asia. And we're going to welcome more phone calls for her in a moment. Thanks, Abu, for your call. Our lines have been busy, but we have a couple openings right now, as well as you can send an email if you would like. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We're looking at a number of issues: the postponed elections, the assassination of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, whether or not it would be a good idea for Musharraf to move on. We're looking at the military. We're looking at the amount of money that's going to the military. We're looking at Islamic militants and whether or not they are gaining strength in Pakistan, and looking at a survey that she had an active part in putting together, a survey of Pakistani public opinion revealing majority support for a moderate and democratic Islamic State. So how do other countries in the world help move Pakistan toward that, if they can? So that's what we're talking about this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, hour number two of our program for this Thursday, the author of Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, is our guest, and we are talking about Pakistan. We go next to G from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm originally from India, and I just wanted to bring up a couple of quick points. The first point is trying to bring up the similarities between Benazir Bhutto and Indira Gandhi. Both were women, both daughters of influential leaders. I'm not going to compare Zulfikar Ali Bhutto with a giant like Jawaharlal Nehru, but for Pakistan he was. Both were corrupt. Both, you know, tried to do things which really upset the population. And I think both were guilty of nepotism. Indira Gandhi tried to put her sons forward. Benazir Bhutto, you know, even through death, he tried to put her son forward now. So that's one point. And the second point is that this is basically, I think, a case of blowback. Back during partition, the British Empire divided India to destabilize the region. And it was continued by the U.S. government, which continued to support Pakistan, which was, for most of the period, not a democracy, against a democracy, a stable democracy like India. And I think it's just coming back to bite USA in the behind. And And my last point is that one must remember that after the 9/11 attacks, Taliban offered to serve up bin Laden on a platter, provided he was taken to the International Court of Justice, which the U.S. refused to do for reasons of its own, you know, in order to continue this war. And I think all of this is basically blowing back.
Christine Fair.
Well, a couple of things. Actually, the history of U.S. relations with India and Pakistan are not as... Well, by the way, the comparisons to Benazir Bhutto and Gandhi, I certainly take. And I would actually add to that the two Begums of Bangladesh. This idea of, everyone likes to point out, the women prime ministers of South Asia without sort of understanding the historical context that allowed these women to emerge. So I certainly agree very strongly with the first point that he made. But actually, the U.S. military relations with India and Pakistan are not as clear as he suggested. The U.S. did try at various moments to have a relationship with India. India pretty much rejected the terms upon which the United States wanted to establish a relationship. And this actually continued. There are numerous bouts of trying to engage India. There was an important effort in 1980 that failed to come to fruition because the Indians wanted technology that the United States did not think was appropriate for a relatively new partner with the United States. And it wasn't until 2000 that the Indo-U.S. relationship really took off. But I mean, that the historical reality of that depiction is somewhat disingenuous, I think. But the most important issue with which I strongly disagree is the Taliban most certainly did not make that offer.
I had never heard that.
It is absolutely, patently, preposterously untrue. I can't make this point any more clearer. The Pakistanis made every effort to get Mullah Omar to realize that not only did their survival depend upon it, that in fact, by getting rid and throwing up bin Laden, the Taliban would be able to retain they were trying to get recognition for the Taliban. If you give up bin Laden, you'll be able to stay here, run this show, and receive recognition as a legitimate government of Afghanistan. And actually, a very interesting point, bin Laden was very clever. Bin Laden and the Taliban actually did not get along all that terribly well, especially in the early years. Mullah Omar didn't know what to make of this fellow. That's why he moved him closer to him out near Kandahar. And when bin Laden began planning the 9/11 attacks, he knew immediately that the Taliban would come under pressure to make a deal. You sell me out and you get to keep Afghanistan and stay the lawful, recognized political leadership here. That's why bin Laden actually had Massoud killed on September 10th, or was it September 9th? Massoud was the most important enemy of the Taliban, and bin Laden rightly assessed that in the ensuing military conflict that would follow the 9/11 attacks, that the U.S. would go immediately to Massoud. So bin Laden took an important step in solidifying his relationship with the Taliban to basically fortify his position against the international efforts to drive a wedge between Mullah Omar and bin Laden. So the caller is absolutely incorrect on that front.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Dave from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. This is a very complex history in terms of the involvement of Pakistan and the Taliban in 9/11 and other ongoing plots. And one of the things that I'm curious about is what information is there that would suggest that the ISI may have been a covert partner in not only 9/11, but other ongoing, you know, operations. That,
Who did you say? I didn't hear.
This is the Pakistani intelligence. ISI, and it seems to me that that may be one of the big issues. Is, you know, are they really essentially an enemy state within the core of the Pakistani military complex and intelligence complex?
Well, I think that that's a very popular statement that the ISI is a rogue elephant. Now, in principle and in broad strokes, I actually reject that. The ISI is officered by the Pakistan Army, and as such, at least at the higher echelons, it's very much under the control of the Army. But the reality of the ISI is that, and we actually know very little, which is kind of funny because we worked so closely with it during the Soviet effort to oust the Soviets. But the Pakistanis were always very careful to regulate who met who. So despite this working relationship for some 10 years plus, we actually have very little visibility in that organization. But what we do think we know, at least, is that you've got these guys who are seconded from the Pakistan Army, and obviously their promotion and their professional trajectory hinges upon their ability to maintain a good relationship with the Army, because that's where they're going to go back. We believe that there are also guys that that get marooned there. They get passed up for promotion in the Pakistan Army, and they kind of stay on as, you know, ISI intel wonks. Then there's a bunch of civilians. Then there's probably a bunch of contractors. I mean, sometimes you'll see ads in the Pakistani newspapers looking for folks to do contract analysis. By the way, you know, our CIA does that too. They hire scholars to do stuff. And then you've got this is where things get really murky. You've got these retired guys. And what are they doing, and with what connection do they have to the formal institution? So my sense is that the ISI is not a rogue institution, but rather it's just more complex than we really want to appreciate, because that might actually mean that the Pakistan government itself has a double game. I've always been of the belief that Pakistan has not seen al-Qaeda as an ally, and it's acted vigorously against al-Qaeda, as evidenced by the most important captures being handed over by the Pakistanis, certainly with help from the United States on the intelligence side. Mm-hmm. That being said, we do believe that very important elements of the Taliban have not only sanctuary in Pakistan, but maybe even protection in Pakistan. And we're talking very specifically about the Quetta Shura and the Shura in Peshawar, people that the journalists can interview, but the ISI claims it can't find. So I think we actually have to look at Pakistan's equities in the region with a little bit more sophistication. And it's very possible that there are parts of the Taliban that the Pakistanis view to be enemies because they're targeting the Pakistani state, and indeed that is the case, while there are certain individuals within the Taliban that Pakistan will need to continue manipulating Afghanistan to its favor. Pakistan knows that one day the international community is going to be gone. It has to live next to Afghanistan. So it's not in Pakistan's favor to make the most important Pashtun political movement at present in the south and southeast in Afghanistan an absolute enemy. So I think it has a much more sophisticated game that it's playing, which also makes dealing with Pakistan very hard. I might add that the U.S. really enjoys, analysts and commentators love talking about Pakistan's perfidy, but very few people actually spend time understanding the strategic environment in which Pakistan is situated. And I would argue that anyone, civilian or military, would undertake some of the decisions that Pakistani leadership has taken with respect to these militants over the years.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about a descent into chaos. Is there? I don't want to leave the conversation feeling that it's inevitable, that there isn't something that the nations on earth can't do to help Pakistan move toward a democracy. I know we've talked a little bit about that. But what needs to be done to prevent the situation from becoming more chaotic, Christine?
Well, you know, this is a really good question. And I used to be very optimistic about Pakistan, particularly in the wake of 9/11 and all of the opportunities that were available to Pakistan in terms of aid and in terms of it was no longer a pariah in terms of really international goodwill to help Pakistan get back on its feet and become stable and prosperous. I think both Washington, London certainly, and Islamabad have all taken a number of steps that have really imperiled Pakistan's long-term stability. And I'm not optimistic that this can be reversed. The U.S. has a large amount of aid that it gives Pakistan. It has chosen to buttress the military. It has chosen to not buttress civilian institutions. Mm-hmm. So at this point, if the United States were, as Congress is presently contemplating, massively cut back on military aid, Pakistanis would make the following conclusions, and indeed are already making that conclusion based upon news reports of imminent aid cutoff, that the United States, in fact, only supports Pakistan when it's ruled by a military. In fact, that has historically been the case. So the task before the United States is, how does it take this huge pot of money and it ensures that the Pakistan military has what it needs to fight the war on terrorism while holding at bay strategic items that are of utility to Pakistan's fight with India, while encouraging Pakistan to not have that fight with India? At the same time, it has to massively plus up its investments, programmed assistance to Pakistan's institutions. And I find it hard to believe that this is going to happen. But we need to have programmed assistance, i.e. not just lump sum payments to the Pakistani exchequer for budgetary support, as has been the case. We need to invest in Pakistan's entire justice sector, from police training all the way up to judicial reform. We need to be engaging in massive training of politicians. Politicians do at all levels, including parliamentarians, don't know how to read the Constitution. They don't know how to read a budget. They don't know how to aggregate local interests and to act upon them. They don't have research libraries. They don't have the ability to understand what's been done, what needs to be done. Things that our Congress takes for granted in terms of support, Pakistani politicians don't have. And of course, all the while, they have to look over their shoulder to see what the army's doing.
Right.
We need to be dealing with the Lawyers Guild. We should be funding NGOs that monitor human rights, that monitor abduction, that monitors corruption. In other words, we need to look at our aid portfolio and we need to ask ourselves, are we helping to build those institutions that
and on that
the
question,
Pakistan that we can live with?
On that question, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much. You're just
thank
a wonderful
you so
guest. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, talking about all that's been going on in Pakistan. Good to get that update. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio and then more Thursday conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.